And one of the things we've worked with P&G recently is I've been slightly just amazed at A, the number of conversations they're having, the number of relationships they're building with not necessarily an expectation on either side that will lead to business, but then also doing a phenomenal amount of transactions where they're buying companies, they're doing license deals, joint ventures. It's really a kind of thousand flowers bloom kind of business model, and it's kind of slightly terrifying. I'll just share with you one example which came out of a workshop we did with them recently, in case anybody's got a solution, and this applies to all the case studies I'm giving. If you have a solution or a suggestion, then come and talk to me, and I'll try and put you in touch with the right people. But P&G sell an awful lot of detergents and washing liquids in pouches. It's the thing these days. But a problem with pouches is if one leaks, it generally destroys the entire packet and it gets thrown away. Ooh. Remind me later, I think. thank you very much.
You carry on.
He's done a good job. Thank you very much. Pouches. If a pouch leaks, it generally destroys the entire packet, and it's the number one thing that consumers complain about in any product that is involved in pouches. So my challenge to you, Cornwall, is: do you have any technology or any method whereby you can easily spot a leaky pouch on an industrial assembly line? If you do, come and talk to me afterwards. It's very big business for somebody like P&G. Anyway, there are tons more of them, and they generally are pushed out. So they're sort of scarily systematic in the way that they hoover up needs and push them out through lots of different channels. And I think I'm going to come back in a minute to something Peter said earlier about kind of give to get, which I think is part of what P&G do in this space. The next lesson I just want to talk about, and this links to some cynicism I have, I think, around the way that large organisations kind of support innovation, and that includes kind of big governments and big government initiatives, which tend to be all about the money and not about the relationship. Partners to Succeed, of course, is a rare counterexample to that statement. But I think the best thing that you can give me as a small company is a paying client that wants what we're selling, not a chunk of cash to develop a product in isolation. And I think a lot of people that are interested in innovation need to get their head more in the space of building client relationships rather than just chasing the money. One example of that that we've worked on is with Orange. I got a great tweet from Woe, is it? Which I retweeted. Those of you on Twitter, go check it out. Especially something to do with the Orange logo. You'll see if you're interested on that. Very funny. Anyway, Orange got themselves in a bit of a cul-de-sac where they were basically really boring, and they were boring themselves and other people. And I think the challenge with collaboration is if you're boring yourself, you're almost certainly boring your customers and the outside world. So you need to remind yourself to inspire yourself and hopefully be interesting to the outside world. It sounds kind of slightly ludicrous thing to say, but it's very, very true. One of the things that we do with people like Orange is we create what's called an innovation airlock, which is a bit of a process where we shield intellectual property between companies like Procter & Gamble and Orange and small companies that maybe want to sell in, and for all sorts of reasons around IP, intellectual property, that's a helpful thing to do. But there's this guy here called Craig who ran a successful small company, turning over about £6 million a year. Which basically hoovers up spare tickets in cinemas and theatres and music venues and comedy venues. And as I say, successful business, but it didn't have the scale and the reach of a company like Orange, which now, through its merger with T-Mobile, has about 30 million customers. Through this process, apparently, according to Craig, it was a tweet that I sent, which ultimately led to a £20 million business deal. So I wish I could somehow get a transaction fee on my tweets, but anyway, that's another conversation. But through this process, Orange and this guy Craig found each other, and they've done a deal. They've piloted it in Manchester and Liverpool with a million customers, and it was due to be launched late in 2011. It's now been, as is often the way with large companies, it's been delayed somewhat, but it's going to happen in 2012. I think this is in part down to the fact that A, Orange were being open about what they were looking for. In that case, they were looking for the next Orange Wednesdays, a big kind of brand proposition that would attract people to the company. The main image here is something, a follow-up project we did with them, which was all around apps to help people do good in 3 minutes or less. So this was all around mobile volunteering, and I'll gladly talk to you if you're interested in that afterwards, but I don't think I have time to go into that today. So kind of bridging this kind of clients not cash, I think is very important, and here's an example where that certainly worked. Yes, and I was going to come to this, interested in what Peter had to say about sort of give to get. I think increasingly, I think the mindset in this space is very much of this ilk. It's to share ideas, resources, time, money, data, often is a good one, or possibly intellectual property, with a view to receiving back all of those things in spades. It requires a different mindset. I'm pleased to see in the survey that seems to be shifting in a sort of 12 to 18 month period. But increasingly, I guess how profoundly, so Nick gave me some scary statistics about the number of emails and the number of YouTube clips and all of that stuff happening in one day. Cisco recently published some data saying that the internet doubles in size every 5 years, which is quite a scary thought in its own right. And I think we live in an era where we have to assume that anything that is digitizable will be shared or certainly shareable. And it's only in rare cases that we keep things secret. I think that in the 20th century, the default was all about being closed and secretive, just because it was easier to be closed and secret. Whereas these days, with the likes of WikiLeaks and the recent Sony scandal where they released loads of credit card data and MPs' expenses and a whole manner of different kind of scandals, the default is increasingly towards openness and closed only in very rare, exceptional circumstances. So I think it requires that open mindset. And a company who I love working with and nobody's ever heard of is Interface. They're a significant company. They're a $1 billion carpet company. And they invented modular carpet tiles, which are basically used in 60% of all offices worldwide. And one of the reasons they have a boring product, carpet tiles, but they sort of have a good heart, if you will. Their founder and chief executive, who sadly passed away last year, Ray Emerson, had a sort of road to, as he himself described it, a road to Damascus moment about 25 years ago, so quite a long time ago, that basically they were polluting the earth with their product, which is predominantly petrochemicals. Carpet tiles are basically bitumen and nylon, both of which are a product of crude oil extraction. And so he set a target then called Mission Zero, which is to eliminate any negative impact the company may have on the environment by 2020. In fact, originally it was, I think, by the year 2000, but they quickly revised it upwards when they realised what a sort of slightly ambitious target that was. But needless to say, in the whole kind of green agenda, which is of course massive and it has been for some time, but Interface were doing this 25 years ago, so they were really kind of ahead of the curve, and I think they have other companies have a lot to learn from the way they've systematised that. Just one example I want to talk about is on this side. I mentioned that carpet tiles are predominantly made of both bitumen and nylon. Fishing nets are predominantly made out of nylon 6 to be precise. When they pass their useful life, they often get discarded on beaches, possibly in Cornwall, certainly all around the world. And there's certainly a lot around India. In fact, it's a big kind of pollution problem, and nobody's doing anything with it. They get burnt, basically, and there's massive piles of them. We're working with Interface at the moment to build a supply chain where local people gather up these fishing nets, they take them to local distribution centres. Those distribution centres send them to a factory in Slovenia, who then break down the fishing nets, turn it into nylon 6, and then Interface turn that back into carpet tile. It sounds like a lot of effort, but if we don't do these things, then the consequences are drastic. So I am pleased that Interface are trying to get their head around these tricky problems. And again, if anybody has, actually, what would be fantastic is a very low-cost detector for nylon 6. So if anybody's got that in the room, come and talk to me afterwards, that would be very helpful. When I say low-cost, I mean for people in fishing communities in India, so it literally has to be very cheap. So anyway, come and talk to me afterwards, that would be great. Lots more I can say about Interface, but I think I'm going to plow through. When I gave this talk last time, I used this quote, and Tim asked me to use it again, because I think it chimed with some of the things that I think grappling with here, which is, again, I think it was Nick who said something about the power is increasingly at the edge, and I think your competition is increasingly not where you thought it was, certainly in the case of the companies that we work with, but I would suggest, or certainly in